Welcome to Protagonists of Change. I'm Nicole Labadee, Director of Campus Ministry at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. Today I'm talking with Father Casey Cole, a Franciscan friar and Catholic priest, blogger at Breaking in the Habit, and author of two books called What Happens After Saying Yes to God and Let Go, Seven Stumbling Blocks to Christian Discipleship. Father Casey, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with me this morning. So first things first, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, thank you, Nicole. It's great to be here. So you kind of wrapped up all the main points there. I guess I'll add that I also am an avid, used to be a baseball player. I love watching baseball and football. I'm from Pennsylvania and North Carolina. I joined the Friars right after college as I was a religious studies major and a poverty studies minor, which you would think would fit perfectly with the Friars, but I did both of those things not wanting to be a priest at all. And I think it was sort of the schooling that influenced me to go this direction. Met the Friars in college and was just moved by their humble nature, the way they served the lowest and the least, the way that they gave an answer for me of what the world needs. So it's been a great life. I have not regretted it even a day.
That's so beautiful. And very similar to myself. So I double majored in religious studies and social work. And then that led to, pursue further theological studies for ministry. But that's awesome that you were so inspired by the witness of the Franciscans that you encountered in college. What was that discernment process like for you?
It was not fun, as I imagine most people can imagine. I was always someone who was in a relationship. I felt that dating was a big part of my identity, that I was going to be married and have kids. And there were two girls in particular that could have been the one. And one of them I was dating while this seed was planted. And I thought, shoot, what am I going to do about this? And so the tearing is very difficult because you feel pulled in two directions. And what I had to come to realize was that there was no one right answer, that God would be pleased with me if I became a biological father and husband, or a religious father. And I think that's something that people struggle to help to understand, is that there isn't one way to live discipleship, but the goal is to live discipleship. So how do we live for Jesus without thinking that there's only one way that God wants us to do it?
So true, so true. Thanks for saying yes to that call. What has your first few years in priesthood been like for you?
Well, I saw someone tweet the other day, someone in my seminary class, that they have been a priest longer in the pandemic than not in the pandemic. And so I realized that is now the case for me as well. Yeah. It has been a strange first year and a half of priesthood. I did get a few months in with, normalcy, but it has really thrown me into a loop in the ways that seminary really didn't prepare me for. And I know everyone complains about that, but most times seminary did prepare you, you just weren't paying attention. No one really prepared me for this. So it's been kind of thinking on your feet. It's been a lot of stepping back and reflecting. Praying has been really important. And so in some ways, I hope that it's a great foundation for the rest of my life, where we would normally just jump in and do. You'd be so busy. This has been almost boring at times, but there's something really fruitful about that as well.
Wow. What are your favorite ways to pray? When you take time for reflection, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, scripture is really important for me. So the Liturgy of the Hours obviously is something that we all as priests pray, but it's the common prayer of the church, so we can all pray it. I love Lectio Divina, so just reading a passage over and over and seeing that unfold. Simply having conversations with God, going through my day, doing the, I won't give the Jesuits too much credit with the examine, but sort of an examine of just what am I feeling right now? What am I thinking? Why is God, giving me these things? I think kind of those essential things of just how's my relationship with Jesus.
Nice. I love that combination of listening to God through both scripture and through just like your lived experience. And what a cool way to think about the pandemic as just more time for that solitude and reflection. What are some things that bring you joy, or what are some of the hobbies that you have?
Well, I love to make videos. I love to evangelize. I've always been the person, I tell this to people, that even before I got into this, I was someone who wanted to tell things to tell people things that I was excited about. So when Stranger Things first came out and I watched it and thought it was the greatest show ever, I told every single person I knew about it for 3 months. Have you seen Stranger Things? And so I love art and entertainment. I love watching movies and things like that, but I love being able to create it myself and to share things that I'm excited about, whether it be religious stuff, which is my YouTube stuff, or my podcast that I have with another friar, where we just talk about movies and TV shows that we like and sort of related to God a little bit, but it's really just because they're good in and of themselves. We love to talk about them. So entertainment, you know, cinematic stuff is really art, stuff that kind of melts my brain sometimes. It makes me see the world in a different way. I really get into that.
Very cool. I did stumble upon the video about Harry Potter, which was just super fascinating. But that's so cool. I'll need to check out the podcast for sure.
Yeah. Hey, Harry Potter is all about death. It's something we Christians can learn from.
Yep. Yeah. There's very much themes of the Paschal mystery throughout throughout that series.
What could be worse than death? They give lots of answers. Betraying your friends, for one.
That's very true. That's very true. I first stumbled upon Breaking in the Habit when I was preparing a resource list for first year college students on Catholic social teaching. This is sort of a mentor resource list for our freshman symposium, which sort of goes into Catholic social teaching. And you have a handful of episodes on that topic, but also so many others. You talk about the church, about faith, Q&A about religious life, music. I saw an episode about Mumford and Sons, mentioned Harry Potter. What inspired you to start Breaking in the Habit? And what's the goal of the YouTube channel?
Well, it started with a blog, and it started 3 weeks before I entered the Friars. I chose a life that not many people chose, and most of my friends had no idea what I was getting involved with. So they wanted constant updates. Hey, tell us what it's like. You know, tell us the real secrets, what happens behind closed doors. And I was like, well, I'm not going to send 50 emails a week. And so another friend of mine had started a blog, and I thought, well, that's a, you know, elegant way of doing this. So I started by writing 2 or 3 posts a week, just what I was thinking, what I was feeling, the experiences I was having, all the things I was learning. And I never wanted it to be, at least not for the first couple of years, me coming off as an expert. I didn't want to teach people things because really I had very little theology. It wasn't about catechesis. It wasn't even really about evangelization. It was simply experiential. Here's what I learned today. Isn't this fascinating? And after about 4 or so years, I started with a road trip, actually, with another friar. He lived in California. He was moving to DC, asked if I would fly out with him and drive back with him. And I said, well, cool. Can we film it? I think that'd be fun. You know, friars on the road 2x2, and we'd stop at different houses along the way and show the way the friars lived. He wasn't really thrilled about it, but I did it anyway. And so we bought a camera and I started the channel. And then I had a camera and a channel. I thought, well, what do I do with this next? And it just kind of became an experiment for a year. I started recording some of the blog posts, showing little aspects of my life, and people were watching. I had more hits in 1 year on the YouTube channel than I did in 4 years on the blog. Believe it or not, people will watch things that they don't read. Yeah. No, that's not hard to believe. And then it kind of went from there. I just experimented for a year or so. And by 2017, the end of my second year, I kind of decided, is this going to be just a hobby I do on the side or a ministry? And it ended up being a ministry. I got funding and have really taken it seriously since then.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And it seems like such a natural expression of that desire and that that passion that you have for sharing the things that you care about, like you named earlier. That's so cool to hear how that came about very organically.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I don't think of myself as particularly naive. No one ever thinks they are, though. But I do think that I bring a pretty optimistic attitude to it, that there are just things in the world that are fantastic that I want to talk about. And I think people should know there's too much bad news in the world. So I think that that's helped my success a little bit, is that I'm just happy about the world and what God's doing in it.
Yeah, you can definitely see and hear your joy when you talk about any variety of topics. So what is your, you mentioned that you see the blog and the YouTube channel as a ministry. What is your like boots on the ground ministry? And how do you balance that time and discern the time spent with the people that you serve and then the people that you serve through technology?
Well, by boots on the ground, I assume you mean sandals on the ground. As people yes, always exactly. comment in winter, where are your shoes? I'm like, folks, I'm in Georgia. It's like 60 degrees out. You know?
Good. Yeah. No need yeah. for boots there.
But it's an act of humility either way. But yeah, so my sandals on the ground, boots on the ground. I'm in Macon, Georgia. I work at a high school, Catholic high school, and an elementary school at a parish. I'm the chaplain at both. I also teach a senior class at the high school. This year, it's advanced social justice. Next year, it's going to be faith in the modern world. Very excited just to talk to young people about faith and get them discussing these sorts of things. It is weird in some ways balancing it, but it is a pandemic. So our in-person stuff is in many ways diminished. And so having an online ministry has really filled the void. I've in the last year done a lot more than I ever did. And it's been great to have all the resources here. I already have a studio. I have a camera. I have the microphones. I've got the lighting. Just spend more time with it. It is a little more difficult than it was before the pandemic. And so you do have to remember, and it's actually fairly easy to remember, that I didn't join this life to be on YouTube. You know, right now I'm technically talking to you, but I'm really just looking at a camera. You know, I'm looking at a screen, and that's not the most fulfilling life to do for 24 hours a day. I joined this life to be with the poor, to be with people who want to learn, to listen to confessions and celebrate the sacraments. And so as effective as some of this stuff is, I could never do this full time. Honestly, I'd run out of things to talk about because it is my life in the world. It's my life in fraternity. It's all the many struggles, honestly, of this world that give me the inspiration to do this. And so finding a balance sometimes can be difficult because it's a demanding job, but it's also just really easy because I don't want to be doing this all the time.
Absolutely. That makes sense. Do any of your students watch your videos?
I hear rumors of that. Yes. Apparently some of the eighth graders in the school here watched them before I even got here.
Wow.
The teacher would show some of the Catholicism and focus stuff for the religion class. So some people had heard of me. Now they'll come up to me every once in a while, like, "Hey, Father Casey, I saw your video. Cool." I'm like, okay, thanks. You know, it doesn't come up all the time, but some of them discover it. It's not something that I promote all that much. You know, I don't go into classrooms and say, like, "Hey guys, you watched my video last week." And so it's always fascinating to me. It just happened, you know, a couple times last week where people came up to me, "Hey, you're on YouTube?" It's like, yeah, did you not know this?
There's that moment of, oh my gosh, my teacher is Catholic famous.
Yeah. whatever that means.
Yeah, right. and you mentioned like that it's taken a different turn and been a little bit easier in COVID. I think for every like parish and ministry, we're rethinking the ways to effectively evangelize and like how we can continue to meet people where they are when we're at our own separate houses and not able to gather in person. That's actually how this podcast came about. We had never done a podcast before. We were like, we need to continue to reach people.
Yeah.
What tips or advice do you have for young people on sharing the faith through technology or through social media?
Yeah, what I often tell people is stick to what you know. And that's not to say don't take risks or do things that are outside your comfort zone. But I do mean don't pretend to be an expert when you're not an expert. We have enough of those people in the religious world that are confusing people. I don't think that you need a PhD. I'm not saying it's necessarily credentialism that only the smartest can talk. But remember that you do have something to share. And so share that, share your experience, share the things that you've learned that you know you can talk about. If you are confused about something, that's perfectly fine. Say so. I don't think there's ever a problem saying, "I don't know," or avoiding a topic because you might muddy the waters. There have certainly been times that I've seen that online. And sometimes I've been tempted to dip my toe in the water of things and realize, you know what? I'm not sure if I've thought about this as much. So that would be the first advice, which is, it sounds negative, but it's actually a very positive thing that you do know something and people do need to know your story, your experience of faith. And in some ways that might be more effective than mine. The silly dress I wear helps me in some ways. It opens a lot of the doors, but it also closes some for others. I'm the elite. I'm the patriarchy. I'm whatever, you know, to some people. Mm-hmm. And so maybe the quote unquote average Catholic can be much more effective in changing hearts than me at times.
Mm. Yeah, points to the just the goodness to be found in different vocations for sure. And I appreciate so much what you said about the sort of the need for humility when it comes to sharing the faith or evangelizing. I also really appreciated that, like you naming that you don't have to be an expert in a topic to talk about your relationship with God or questions that you're working through with the church. I think that's something that students say whenever they're preparing a retreat talk is, oh, well, I'm not a theology major. I can't give a talk. And we're like, no, like you have a relationship with God, just like any other person of faith. You can talk about that and you can share that experience.
Honestly, I think experts are a turnoff to some people because they feel like they've got everything figured out. And if I don't have it figured out, maybe it comes off as a little domineering. Whereas there's something very beautiful about asking a question, saying, you know, I'm really struggling with this and I just want to share you. I don't have any answers. I just have some questions. Maybe other people can relate to that.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that I really appreciate about your show. In particular, the way that you are not afraid to engage those hot button topics or those tough questions about the church. But you do so with just a genuine authenticity. And one of the topics that you have a few videos on is ecclesiology or the theology of the church. So as someone who works for a Catholic university, Catholic identity is something that's at the forefront of a lot of our minds and certainly of our activities. You know, how does this serve the mission of the university? What does Catholic identity mean to you?
Catholic identity. I think it has to start with Jesus Christ. And I think that that is so obvious and yet so necessary. So often in our history, we've defined what it means to be Catholic based on what we are, what makes us different from other people. And you see this through the ecumenical councils. The things that we define are not necessarily the most important thing. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're simply a way to correct problems that they've seen in the world, correct heresies, to say that we are not that. And that's true and that's necessary. But we could look to Trent in the Protestant Reformation. There were a lot of things that we had in common that were, in fact, much more important that Trent said nothing about because they didn't feel like they needed to say anything about. And I think that attitude can spill over to our world today where we can say, well, I'm not Protestant, so therefore that's what I am. But no, what you are is a positive thing. It is a disciple of Christ. It is someone who lives the Beatitudes. It's someone who engages in the corporal works of mercy. I think these are the essential things, those who evangelize. And yes, we have a culture, and I think culture is fantastic. And there are particular, even man-made rules that are good. So that's what religion is in some ways. It is, how do we take this spiritual deposit of faith that we've received and keep ourselves on the straight and narrow? Not every rule that we have as Catholics comes from God. Some of it is just the reflections of holy men and women to say, here's how we can make sure that we stay on the right path. But the way we stay on the right path, those means are not God himself. And sometimes I think we make idols out of that. Sometimes the rules that we have, the ways that we pray, the ways that we engage others, our identity markers, they can be the fullness of who we are. And that's a problem. And so I always push back whenever we put qualifiers in front of Catholic. You know, I'm a progressive Catholic. I'm a traditional Catholic, you know, except for, you know, the particular rites, but even still, you know, I'm a Roman rite. I'm a, you know, a Byzantine rite. Those are helpful, but remember our core identity is disciple of Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hear, in addition to those, I hear like, oh, well, I'm not that Catholic, or she's super Catholic. When, yeah, like you said, that it's our relationship with Jesus Christ that makes us Catholic.
I hear I'm, you know, a devout Catholic all the time. And I, to life of me, I don't know what devout Catholic really means and how we rate that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like many topics in theology, there's this tension that exists in the church between identity and relevance. So this is one that's felt very deeply, obviously, because the church is in the world, but not of it. So our identity, like you said, is in Christ, and the fullness of God's revelation through him. And at the same time, we're called to really engage the world, to communicate and to share that revelation in a way that people at different points in history in different cultural contexts can understand. What does it mean for the church to be relevant?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, balancing the particular and the universal. So despite what I just said about kind of the intra questions of the church, of how we define ourselves within the church, I think defining the church against the rest of the world, there is some really interesting points that we can make that are differences, that we can say we are this and not that. And that's really helpful. We don't want to be just like the rest of the world. It's why someone like myself and many in the church love the habit. It's very distinct and it's very different. And it says so much. It's more than just a sign. It's a symbol filled with meaning of this is the way I live. Here's what I believe. Here's what I don't do. And I think Catholics, particularly today, and young people are reaching for these symbols. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that when we relativize everything and we say everyone's all the same, that's pretty uninspiring. And we shouldn't be like the world and we shouldn't be like everyone else. And so having identity markers like that can be really helpful for evangelization because it says we stand for something. Our liturgy should be special. It should be distinct. It should have meaning beyond just let's all get together and share our feelings. Well, we do that every other place. You know, there should be an objective reality. There should be something that draws us out of ourselves. And so how we be relevant, it's a weird balance of we want to speak to the world in ways that the world understands. But I think if we just speak the language of the world will just say, yeah, well, I found that somewhere else. There's something about saying, well, we're different and not in a pejorative sense, like you look how bad you are and point the finger, but in an inviting sense of we're an inclusive difference. You can come and bring who you are. Sure, absolutely. That's the wonderful thing about our Catholic faith is that we have many rites. We have many cultures, that we are the universal church, not the uniform church. And so if you're from a different country, different culture, different language, have different opinions about certain things, to some extent, we're all welcome. But there is this overarching identity that we can all play into that is different from what you're used to.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. I think that's a beautiful way of describing that. It's definitely a both and, it's not an either or. You named that, like you spoke about how the liturgy should be special and something unique and something different, to where someone can go in and realize, okay, this is not of this world. Like this is communion with God. One of the critiques that I hear a lot from young people today is that the changes in the liturgy since Vatican II have sort of helped to contribute to a mass that's more of the world and less other, less, like with the vernacular language, with different changes in music, that sort of thing. And that the response then should be to return to only a Latin mass or liturgy in a particular way. What are the ways that liturgy in particular has that distinction, that special quality to it? What are the ways that liturgy does that while still recognizing the native language through which people pray?
Yeah, so I think it's great to have a language like Latin that is in some ways universal, that we can kind of standardize this in some ways. And so no matter where you are in the world, we can come together and have a way to pray. When I was in Mexico for a couple months, there were certain parts of the liturgy they still did in Latin. And it was great. It was like, oh my gosh, I already know this, you know, and I didn't speak Spanish. The argument that I hear for some that it should all be in Latin because we need a special language that no one speaks primarily, that God needs his own language, I'm a little more reticent about, because it's great. God can have his own language, but if I don't speak it, it means nothing. You know, that there has to be something that speaks to my heart as well. And so again, it's that balancing of the universal, but also the particular. I want to be able to experience God as I know in my heart, that there are certain aspects of culture, certain aspects of language that are fundamentally important. And we should be okay in the Catholic Church, especially in the Catholic Church, to be in communion in our differences. I love linguistics. I love studying them. Even though I'm really bad at languages, I love learning how certain languages have ways to express things that my language doesn't, and how it represents a view of the world that I don't necessarily have. And I can only think that this makes our liturgy better, that you are able to be particular. And it does not take it away from me that you celebrate in Spanish or French or, you know, Swahili, and I celebrate in English. I think it makes our church better. And so having, again, that both and. So sure, let's have certain aspects of the Mass in Latin so that we can all remember that it's more than just my particular church. Mm. But let's have a lot of it in our own particular languages with our own particular cultures so that we can give an intimate expression of God, something that I know deeply in my heart rather than just I'm assenting to something I know I'm supposed to do. Yeah. I think that there, my answer to all, most of your questions probably going to be both and, because that's our Catholic model. And I think that that's just the beauty of it.
Mm. Thank you so much for that. And I love that vision of, incorporating those, the like elements of Latin and the symbols, the things that make liturgy distinct and universal, while also like holding on to, okay, what helps a person encounter God who comes from different places or from a different family background?
I can give you an example. I mean, something that may not represent our culture, but if you go to some African countries, one of the traditions that are in some places is you have some leader woman in the community bring up the gospel of the church, and they can bring it, kind of on their head as they bring the water, they bring the meal from the market. And there's a strong symbolism to it that they're the ones who go to the market. They're the ones who go to the cities, and they bring back the good news to their own particular villages. And so why wouldn't they be the ones who bring the good news to be proclaimed? There's something very subtle about that. And maybe that wouldn't make sense if we made that a rule in, Western, American, English-speaking countries. But in certain places, that is a custom that makes perfect sense, and it brings out the fullness of what the good news means.
Yeah, yeah, that's a beautiful example. Thank you for sharing that. There's a growing number of nuns in the church. And by this, I don't mean sisters, for those of you listening. N-O-N-E-S. So people who, when they go to a demographic survey, they for the question about religious affiliation, they check the box of nun. In particular, like this number is increasing in recent years, not just for Catholics, but especially for Catholics, but also for just religion in general. What can the church do? And in particular, how can we make our core worship experience of liturgy something that engages those who might be disaffiliated with the church?
Yeah, I think I'd like to remind people that 75% of statistics are made up. everything needs context, right? So that is, I think, a true statistic. As the number of nuns continues to increase, that is a reality we should not ignore. But I think it also needs the context of recognizing that the number of people who find spirituality to be important has sort of leveled off. It's not dropping at the same rate. And so while people may not be religious, may not have an affiliation to a church or to a synagogue, to a particular religion, they are asking deep questions, and they are wondering about the cosmos and about the origins of life and about morality and how we can be people of service. That's something particular among my generation. I know that service was very important, maybe above and against faith, but it was certainly something I saw even in my non-religious friends, that you wanted to go do something good for the world. And so while that's not the same thing, it should give us help in the way that we approach the solution, which is that we don't want to just say they're a depraved generation that don't care about anything and they're just going out and getting drunk and living debauchery lives. Right. There's something that is yearning in people. And so how do we tap into that? People who think that they're spiritual but not religious, great. Let's promote the spirituality. Let's encourage them, go deeper with these questions. And you know what? Once you find yourself coming to maybe some answers, well, here's a life that you can live to make sure you stick to that. And let's show the beauty of how religion is not antithetical to spirituality, but in fact is a way to do it together. So it's not all about you and your own quest, but it's something we do, and we support each other. And we have not only today's answers, but we have yesterday's answers. We've got the tradition of the church. So you don't even have to come up with it all yourself. So yeah. I think there's something to that of they're not the same thing. Spirituality is still there. And I recognize this among my students who find religion to be man-made and it's abusing people and whatnot. And there's some truth to that, but that doesn't mean they're completely depraved. How do we build that up?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, every human being has that innate longing for something more, which we as Catholics recognize as a desire for God and for the fullness of life and communion with Him. So often it's like, it's helping people to name that question or to recognize that deeper longing for what it is. Like you said, the two aren't in competition necessarily, like religion in the Catholic faith, the fullness of it, like, is an answer to that, to those questions that a lot of young people are asking today. I know that with Vatican II, there was a call for full conscious and active participation in the liturgy on the part of the laity. How do you, what encouragement would you say for people who go to Mass maybe out of a sense of obligation, or come away with it not necessarily like feeling like they got anything from it? What are the ways that we as laity can fully consciously actively participate in the liturgy?
Yeah, I mean, the liturgy is an objective reality in that there are words that are to be said and actions to be done, and it works or doesn't work, right? Like, it's either valid or invalid. And so there's nothing a laity can do about that. But there is also a subjective reality to it. There is something about the way we sing, the way that we respond, about the way we prepare and listen. This is the cultural aspect again, that we have some rules that liturgy has to follow, but there's also a lot of free space in between that, of how we are going to engage with that. And so for the laity, I would say it is the particular experience of each day going and individually responding with fervor, or listening attentively, maybe preparing and reading the readings beforehand or meditating on them, maybe really taking seriously those pauses, those silences in the Mass that are built in to offer your sacrifice. When the priest says, "Let us pray," and pauses, he's not just like bored or tired. He's giving the laity an opportunity to offer their prayers. And then he puts his hands up and collects them all and gives them to God. And so are you using that time fruitfully? And so that's the particular thing. But I think the larger picture then is, maybe your music is really bad at your church, or maybe your priest is not a good preacher, or maybe liturgy is just a mess. Well, there's an opportunity to get involved yourself. Maybe you can volunteer in some ways and add to this. Maybe you can offer your own bits of wisdom to the priest. Not everyone loves, you know, unsolicited advice, but there are ways that feedback can be really helpful. And you can say that, you know, this liturgy quite literally is the work of the people. It's not the work of the priest. I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it with you. And so if you have not prepared in a big scale sense, if you've not given your own feedback, planned a liturgy, made sure that it has some, you know, a larger sense of planning throughout the year, maybe that's an opportunity to say, I need to get more involved in this. This needs to be my work as well.
I love that. I love that. I know at UST, our chaplain is very, very open to that. And in particular, we're like, yeah, wanting the students to participate in those ways more, always trying to encourage that level of participation. So,
I mean, one example, you know, we have the prayers of the faithful. Technically, that is the role of the deacon. You know, spiritually, he's the one who goes from the table out to the community and brings the prayers back and all that. And maybe you don't have a deacon. Maybe the deacon needs help with that. What if you said, you know, I'm a very concerned member of this community. Father, would you mind if I write the prayers of the faithful? Would you mind if we had a committee that got together and we really shared our concerns? There's no reason you couldn't do that. I think that'd be a beautiful way to say, this now represents us and our concerns quite particularly. Just one example, I think you go through many aspects of the liturgy and see that there's a lot of flexibility for the laity to get involved behind the scenes.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's bringing to mind, there's one canon in the Code of Canon Law that says that at times the faithful have the right and at times the duty to manifest to their sacred pastors matters that pertain to the whole of the faith of the people of God. So that's just like a very clear example of the laity being co-workers almost in a sense, truly participating in the liturgy. So we've talked a lot about worship, but at the end of the Mass, we're sent forth to go and to love and serve God and neighbor. Tell me a little bit more about that moment of the Mass for you, like as a priest, when you send people out. What is your hope and your prayer for them at that moment?
It's fascinating that what I'm about to say, because people don't expect a priest to ever say this, but my trouble working with young people sometimes is that they want to stay in the church forever. They want to live in the church, and I want to tell them, get the heck out of here. Like, it's so weird to be telling people to go away from the church. But the reality is it has to be, again, that both ends, that the liturgy is the source and summit, but it's not the only thing we do. It's the source and summit of our life that sends us out to live our normal lives so that we can bring Christ to the rest of the world and then bring some of the world back to the liturgy. It's this kind of ebb and flow back and forth. But if you never go to the world, then you miss the point. You become what Pope Francis talks about, it with this kind of insular, sick church that never goes out. Instead, Jesus tells us to go out. Think about how many missions he sends the disciples on. The very last words, go and baptize in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, evangelizing all nations. There's something about going out and bringing that message of changing the world, of building the city of God, and then bringing some of the broken and battered and the weak and the sick back to the church so that it can be healed. If you just stay in the church, if you ignore that dismissal, then I'm not sure if you got the point of the church. It's sort of a, give me the communion wafer, give me Jesus for myself, and I'm just going to sit here and selfishly hold on to him forever. That's not what our Christian life is about. And so as strange as it sounds, I say, take that go seriously, get out of here so that you have actually something to bring back to the church.
Wow. What a powerful call. Yeah. We're called to take seriously that invitation and that command to go and to be Christ to others. Yeah. So I want to close with some of the difficulties that people might experience in the going out. So I know in particular, I don't want to say debates, but there's a lot of conversations, or it's tempting when we go out and engage with others of differing opinions, or maybe they have different preferences when it comes to liturgy or different ideas about what it means to be church. What is the way forward in that? What is the role of us as a Catholic Christian disciple? How can we enter into those conversations well?
Yeah, so there's two kind of approaches to this, or two, I guess, ends to this. One is that we're evangelizing the rest of the world, and we've talked about that a little bit, and we can talk about how we offer something that the world doesn't have, and I think that's great. And there are certainly some enemies of the church outside the world we need to be wary of, and great. That is one thing that I think we talk about a lot. The thing I'm more interested in some ways more concerned about, is those debates we have within the church. I find that the enemies of the church, the most vocal ones, are often within the church. And if we think about the story of Jesus, it wasn't the atheists that were attacking Jesus. It wasn't the Romans, the pagans, the people of other faiths. It was his own brothers and sisters. It was those within the religious elite that were the biggest problem. And I think that's still the case today. And you take one look at Twitter and you see these battles between Catholic priests and the clericalism and the condescension you see, and it's disgusting. Why would anyone want to join this church? There's room for debate, and there are certainly right and wrong answers in a lot of places. And I recognize that people are passionate about finding the truth, but you can't have truth if you also don't have love. And I know that sounds strange to people because, 2 + 2 = 4, whether I shout at you and swear at you or not. And that's facts. But truth is something different. Truth is meaning. And so if we're going to say that God is love, and if we're going to say that Jesus sent us out to love our enemies, and we want to share the gospel, and we do so with hate, then in fact, we're not sharing the truth. Our actions undermine who we are. And so if we want to get in debates and we want to evangelize, we want to change people's hearts, it begins with the way that we treat people. And so I always remind people that, get in debates. Yeah, sure. Argue your case. Let's find the truth. But never stop being a Christian. Read the Beatitudes before you go and criticize anyone. Think about the corporal works of mercy and what Jesus calls us to do before you go and call someone a heretic. I think it's important to remember that who we are as Christians is the most effective way to evangelize. It's how we treat people, not necessarily what we say, that people will remember. And so if you don't love your enemies, they're going to know this. They're going to know that you are treating them with disrespect. And so they're not going to listen to you. So enemies outside the church, inside the church, you have to love them. You have to start with a mutual respect. You have to start with being Christian. And I think things will take care of themselves from there. If you don't, then I think we're wasting our time.
So we like to close our episodes with an example of a saint. Do you have a favorite saint or saint who inspires you that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, obviously, St. Francis is kind of important to me. Yes. That's too easy of an answer. But I will say I actually fell in love with a saint before he was a saint and before I knew St. Francis, and that's St. Oscar Romero. Someone who had a great conversion in his own life, although it's played up a little more than it actually was, but he did have a conversion. He did see things in a new way and decided he needed to change his life. And so I'll leave you with just one line that I absolutely love with his, of his, and it reminds me of the Beatitudes. He says, "There are certain things in life that can only be seen through eyes that have cried." There's something about crying yourself and feeling the pain of others that helps you get insight into those people. And while you may have an intellectual understanding of what they're going through, unless you've cried yourself, you'll never know their sorrow. And so it calls us to empathy, to live the Beatitudes ourselves so that we can go out and experience what people experience.
If you made it this far, thanks for sticking with us. We would love to hear from y'all. How do you use technology to evangelize? And how can you share that good news and be an example and witness to the truth and love with both those with the world and those in the church? Let us know. Hit us up on social media at Kelp Campus Min on Instagram and Facebook. Share this with your friends, family, coworkers, classmates, you name it. And we invite y'all to listen to our other episodes, which dive into social justice, prayer, discernment, just to name a few. You've been listening to Protagonists of Change. I'm Nicole Labadie, and until next time, peace.